messieurs, chers auditeurs de l'émission Samedi Midi Inter, ici votre serviteur Raymond Laurent qui vous donne rendez-vous demain à 14h pour une émission spéciale d'1 heure. Nous allons bien sûr souligner le triste anniversaire du tremblement de terre du 12 janvier 2010. Tremblement de terre qui a bouleversé le pays dans son ensemble. Un témoin oculaire va m'accompagner pour cette émission spéciale. Le propriétaire associé de l'hôtel Visa Lodge, Monsieur Hervé Denis, sera avec moi, et l'ancien ambassadeur d'Haïti à Washington, également l'ancien ministre de la Défense. C'est un rendez-vous à ne pas manquer sur les ondes de Radio CKUT de l'Université McGill à Montréal.
If you're young at heart, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. We come to you monthly every second Wednesday of the month between 6 and 7 p.m. My name is Laura Yaros, and I'll be one of your co-hosts today, and I'll be covering the first half of the program, and then our sister collective member, Rosemary Wally, will be coming to you with the second half of the program. We're going to be covering two topics today. The first is the Women's Age Lab, a very interesting and important new organization focusing on the health and well-being of older women. We'll get into that in a minute. And then the second half of the show, Rosemary Wally interviews Simri Gomri about the growing opposition to the proposed purchase of 88 fighter jets by the federal government. So we've got a lot to cover, and let's get to it. Last week, I had the opportunity to interview Dr. Paula Rochon, who's the founding director of the Women's Age Lab, located in Toronto at Women's College Hospital. Dr. Rochon is a geriatrician and senior scientist at Women's College Hospital. She's the founding director of Women's Age Lab. She's also a professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto. And she is the inaugural Retired Teachers of Ontario Chair in Geriatric Medicine, also at the U of T. Her research focuses on understanding the unique needs of older adults, particularly older women, and promotes their health and wellness. So my first question was how she came to found the Women's Age Lab.
Well, you know, I'm a geriatrician and I'm a health services researcher. So I've always been interested in things related to older people. And probably that actually goes back to my grandparents. You know, I had a grandfather who lived to 100 and almost 103. And I had a grandmother who, you know, at that time, I didn't really think had lived, you know, nearly to that age, but actually had lived well into her 90s. And what was kind of interesting about both of them is they'd both been so well and they'd aged so well that it always made me wonder, you know, what are some of the things that you can do to promote health and wellness with aging? So something that I was always interested in and probably was one of the reasons why I decided to go into geriatric medicine, you know, where we focus on caring for older people in the first place. I always kind of had that interest. And in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, you know, what about older women, you know, in a lot of the work that I did? And I remember back in one of my early projects when I was doing my master's of public health, we were asked as part of the class to review literature. And I remember being given boxes of files that were of clinical trials of drugs that were being used to treat arthritis. And I think, as you know, you and I could probably imagine, arthritis is a condition that's more common in older people, more common in women than men. And going through all of these, you know, many, many, many trials, I started noticing that there wasn't a lot of, it didn't appear older people included in these trials. And even when they were, the information really wasn't reported. And so as a result of that, you really couldn't learn much about older people or women who were going to be the people most likely to take these drugs in the end from these trials. And it started making me think, you know, well, why is that? And I must say that sort of set me off on a whole sort of series of events and looking at this issue in a variety of different contexts and just seeing that over and over again, we were missing out important information about older people and especially women that might help us improve the way we care for them and improve health and wellness with aging. So long story, but something that I've always been interested in, and it's work that I've been continuing to do throughout my career.
I read that the Women's Age Lab was founded just last year in 2021. How did that come together, like for last year, especially given the context we're living in now with the pandemic?
The idea of being able to focus in on older women is just something that I've always thought is so important. And, you know, my clinical work as a geriatrician caring for older people, over and over again, I would see differences in the way I thought we should be caring for women and men, and just a lack of information about that. So it was really just a dream come true to be able to focus all of my energies on this one issue. So we launched Women's Age Lab in October of this year. So just very recently.
Very recent.
But it's sort of long overdue, shall we say. And I think it's, you know, some people have used the word shocking, and I think that's the case, to think that, to our knowledge, we're the first research group that's focusing on you know, ways to improve health and wellness of older women, you know, starting with science in the world that we can find. Really? And, you know, when you think of the fact that, you know, here we are in Canada about to be a super age society and more older women than there are even men, you know, a very important group. And, you know, nobody seems to be particularly focusing on them. So something that's long overdue, something that's much needed. And so we are so excited to be the first center really focusing on this.
So are you funded in some way, or did you have to raise funds to do this, or you just set it up on your own?
So we're based at Women's College Hospital, and we do have some initial support. But in all of our work, we're drawing on grants. So we apply for funding through, you know, the peer review process to support the work that we're doing. And in addition to that, of course, we are also fundraising to support the initiative. You know, even though what we're focusing on, you know, you think you're focusing on older women and you're already focusing on, and it's kind of a niche area, I think you can imagine it's actually huge. You know, there's so many different components that you could look at. So this is, I think, something that's, as I say, based at Women's, but it's relevant across Canada and it's relevant internationally. So something that we definitely will be wanting to build support for. When we were starting out, we were thinking about what would our areas of focus be on older women, because we just couldn't do everything. You know, there's so much to do. So we had to pick our areas, and that was sort of some of the first bit of work that we had to do. The areas that we're focusing on relate to our work where we've done a lot of our science. So we're looking at issues related to how do we optimize the use of therapies for older women. We're looking at issues related to congregate care and how do we improve congregate care. And
could you just define for our listeners, what is congregate care?
Yes, it's probably too fancy a term. So basically what we're talking about is settings where people live together. So the setting that would be most common for people in the Canadian context would be thinking about long-term care or nursing homes are sort of the settings that most often come to mind when you think about that. But that's, you know, a very important group for women as well. And we're also looking at some of the social issues that are important for older women, like loneliness. You know, I mean, that's an issue that I think is particularly important for people as they get older. And I think one that obviously I think all of us, I must say, are very much relating to, you know, during this whole COVID piece. So, you know,
yeah.
Sometimes when you learn about certain groups, you learn things that are helpful for everybody. And the last piece that we're focusing on right now is around the idea of how do we reduce gendered ageism? You know, so you hear about ageism, you know, discrimination based on age, but often we don't really hear about the idea of gendered ageism, which is where you have discrimination based on not only your age, but also your sex. So it's kind of like a dual discrimination, which I think is a particular issue for older women, and one that kind of maybe underlies a lot of the things that we're talking about. So one that we just want to talk about, and we want to make sure that we're out there to address. And the other thing that for the Women's Age Lab, which I think is so exciting, is we're taking science, like, you know, we're very much scientists and have been embedded in this world all of our careers, but we're finding ways to, how do we put it into action? You know, how do we actually use this information to drive change? And then taking it a step further, let's make sure we're out there talking about it so that the public is aware, you know, that this is something that affects all of us, so that everyone is talking about it and bringing it to attention of, you know, people like policymakers, so that we're really able to start making a real difference ultimately with the goal of improving health and wellness for older women.
So concretely, I mean, I know it's probably still in the early stages. You only started this in October. Have there been any projects or specific concrete endeavors that have commenced at this point?
You know, you're right. This is early days, but we are building on, you know, a huge amount of work that we've done for decades really in this area. So we're not starting from ground zero. It is building on a number of different projects. But for example, if you talk about issues related to gendered ageism, you know, that's an issue that I think people are not really so aware of. And so what we've done in that regard is we've started writing about it. And so we've put it out there. We wrote a comment that was published in The Lancet that talked about this issue, that kind of, in a sense, responded to other work we'd seen where they talked about ageism, but we've said, you know, what about women and how is it different for women? So we brought it to their attention. And then following that, we got approached by one of the major economic organizations, the OECD, to ask if we could write about it for people who are interested in it from, you know, perhaps thinking about pensions and retirements and other kinds of issues like that. So a different kind of audience. And so we wrote about it there as well and talked about some of the issues that we think need to be brought to attention. So for example, when you think about gendered ageism and how that, you know, impacts older women today, if you think back on their lives, when these women were younger, which is, you know, many decades ago, women were much less likely to be in the paid workforce. And as a result of that, when they were less likely to be in the paid workforce, they may not have the same opportunities to accrue income and pensions over time. And further, when they were in the workforce, they, you know, perhaps got paid less and they had to take time off. You know, so many stories I've heard from older women, you know, talking about when they were having their children, they actually had to leave work and they lost the ability to accrue pensions over that period of time. Or, as we know, women are more likely to be caregivers. So perhaps, you know, maybe chose to stay home with their children or needed to do that. Or later in their careers, and something people forget about, women are often perhaps more likely to be caregivers for parents or older relatives, and that takes time away from their work. So as a result of this, when women eventually retire, they're more likely to have a pension that is at the same level as their male counterparts. And one of the pieces that's been, you know, talked about is pensions are on average about a quarter less for women than they are for men, which has impact on their ability to do lots of things that you might have to purchase over time, things that don't necessarily get covered by healthcare. You know, maybe it's things like glasses, which are, you know, kind of important, or, you know, yeah, we're both wearing glasses. You know, these are things we take for granted, but hey, they're expensive, you know.
Well, they sure are.
So, you know, we want to raise awareness of these sorts of issues that are potential inequities that we need to find ways to address. These are issues that, you know, older women today have gone through, but younger women today also need to be thinking about and need to be raising issues about, you know, what can they do in that regard? So these are issues that are really important pieces. And another concrete area, we've done a lot of work related to how do we optimize therapies for older people and especially women. So I think I told you that one of my earliest projects kind of got me into this when I looked at how drug treatments for arthritis were not really including older people and in particular giving us information about women that might be useful. And we know this is important because, you know, often women have more chronic conditions that they might take medications for. And in some cases, we've been finding things like, for example, women may require different doses than men. For example, women may require a slightly lower dose. And, you know, that's the kind of information that you need to have in terms of improving health and wellness. So some of the work that we're doing internationally is looking at prescribing practices for older people, especially looking at differences for women and men and thinking about what are the ways that we can reduce unnecessary polypharmacy and when people end up on a lot of different medications, a particular issue for women. And how can we make sure that older adults and especially women are taking only the medicines that they need and at the doses that they need for their conditions? So that's another very concrete piece that we're working on.
So you're basically doing literature surveys and other kinds of research to see what's already been done, like in other words, to look for data, I guess, that you can
Yes.
use to promote these things. I'm wondering, are you also planning, I mean, it's early, but are you also planning to do your own studies on things like, for example, medications? Or one thing I'm thinking of in particular, sometimes certain medical conditions might manifest differently for women than for men. And I'm thinking particular because I had a relative of mine and also a musician that I respected very much, both women in their 60s, and they went to the hospital or their doctor with symptoms like a backache or something with their throat, and they died in their sleep and it was a heart attack. And I know in the case of the musician who I was shattered when I learned that she died at 63, and apparently the day before she'd gone to the hospital with a backache and they sent her home. And the next day she went for a walk, she lay down for a nap, and that was it. And I was both shattered because, you know, I was sad, but I was also so angry because I felt this wasn't the first time I had heard that women don't manifest a heart attack the way men do. You know, when you see it on TV where they clutch their chest and they clutch their arm and they crash to the ground. Women don't manifest symptoms in that way most of the time. So, I mean, there may be other conditions where it manifests differently in women. I'm wondering if that's something that you might be focusing on in the future, or if you've already learned some things around that.
Well, I think you've touched on something that's hugely important, you know, and I think that's the kind of reason why we're doing this and why we're putting this out here, you know, talking about Women's Age Lab and how we need to look at what are things that are different between not just older and younger people, but between women and men, and especially older women and older men. But it touches on those things that you've just said, you know, whether it's looking at how drugs are prescribed or the different kinds of ways that conditions may be more common in women and men or present differently in women and men. And you also talked to the issue of data, you know, and if you're not looking for this information and getting people to be thinking about this when they're doing all of their studies, no matter what they are, you'll miss out. So, for example, you talk about this issue about heart disease, and that's one that people are paying more attention to now. Traditionally, people have thought about it in the context of men, how men present with heart disease, as you say, that the typical, like an elephant on my chest, you know, some radiating down your arm, that kind of thing. But women, we're learning, may, as you said, in the stories that you described, which are, you know, so sad, you know, they may present with things that are very different. It may be just not really feeling quite well or nauseated or things that are not sort of that sort of, shall we say, textbook example. And so people need to be aware that people present differently. So same condition can present differently in women and men. But it also can be that women are more likely to show up with different kinds of problems. You know, for example, thyroid disease, you know, something more common in women than men. Or headaches, that's something that's more common in women than men. Or some of the bone problems that we experience, like osteoporosis, is another thing more common in women and men. So there are all of these things that we need to think about. And, you know, we can't just think about all older people as all being the same. And we can't just think about women as being all the same. We need to recognize that there's differences based on sex and also based on age. And that's so important to do. And that gets back to the idea of how do we get that information? So at Women's Age Lab, we're starting by looking at a couple of these areas, like four major areas that we're looking at. But you can imagine that this relates to everything. So one of the pieces we're talking about is the need to think about having sex and age disaggregated data. So if you're studying heart attacks, or if you're studying lung conditions, or if you're studying skin conditions, you're able to say, okay, how might there be patterns that might be different for older women relative to older men? And if you don't look and ask those questions, you won't see them. And so we want to make sure that everyone is, you know, kind of our mantra, sex, age, disaggregated data, something that's really important to help us see these patterns and to look for these differences, because that's the information that we need to guide our clinical care and identify priorities going forward.
So you can, I imagine, harvest some of that data from previous studies where they might not have been focused on what you just explained, but the data is there and nobody bothered to tease it out.
That's also very important too, right? Because even if you say, I don't think this is the focus of my study, and I'm not going to have a large enough sample, say, for example, to really make a statement about it, if you took your study plus somebody else's study and the next study and you start putting that together, all of a sudden you have enough information. So it's something that's important for people to do irrespective, and other people can go back and ask their questions, or it's something that might be, you know, we encourage people to do that in all of their research, so that, you know, information is available so you could tailor your results and tailor your therapies to the needs of older women and older men.
I guess my hope also is that the lab will be able at some point to start doing, to conduct its own studies on different questions, you know, not just only relying on data that was previously collected, but that it can also collect its own data on some of these areas that we just discussed.
Yes, and we are doing that. So just to be clear about that. So one of the ways we get data for a lot of our work is from our provincial data sets. So in Ontario, we have access to data on all of the older adults, which means that we can look at everybody. So for example, if people are looking at drug therapies, it's not just people that made it into the clinical trials, but you can look at everyone, you know, older people, younger people, women, men, you can look at those different groups. So we're doing that in our studies that are looking at different therapies and how do we optimize those for use by older women. We're using that kind of data. We're also using it to start exploring issues around things like social isolation and loneliness. And so we are able to look at existing data that's out there to start looking at that and to start thinking about what are things that we can do differently that might be helpful to older people, especially in different settings of care. So you're right, data is incredibly important. It's the data that we have and the projects we're doing. But what I'm saying is this is such a big issue that we need lots of partners. We need people that are interested in working with us and exploring it in their areas as well so that we can really make progress in this area.
Differences in attitudes towards older people and older women in particular in different countries, like, for example, in some European countries or in African countries or in Asian countries or in North America, the attitudes towards older people are often quite different. Like, for example, one of my colleagues who works on this show with me, actually, she was one of the founders of this radio program. She had been a teacher teaching English to immigrants, and she became very close with an Afghani woman. And she ended up accompanying this woman back to her town in Afghanistan. You know, she went to visit her family and she was invited to come along. They were very poor people in a small village living very simple life. But she really noticed the difference in that the older people still had their role to play. Like everybody had their role, like even the children had a role, like 5 and 6 year olds and the adults, they were out working. And then the grandparents, especially the grandmother, was in charge of looking after the children. And she actually had her role to play. She wasn't just sitting around being, quote unquote, retired. The thing that struck me, I tell this story a lot because it really struck me. She was explaining to a group of women and children, because of course it's very sex segregated there. So there were women and children. And she was explaining to them how in North America, where she lives, older people are often institutionalized. You know, they don't live with their families a large percentage. They're put in institutions or they live alone in, you know, these places. And literally, she said, the women and even the children, they all started crying because they just were so horrified and so like, oh my God, like how awful for you. And they were literally crying. Oh, and of course, these people live very harsh lives, as you know, in a little village in Afghanistan, you can imagine, especially the women. But yet my colleague just was so struck by the respect and that the women still, they were still a part of the whole ecosystem of the society. And I'm wondering if there's any focus on the attitudes towards older people and older women in particular in some of the work that you're doing, or is that something you're contemplating? Because I guess I feel that some of this is due to attitudes that we have about older people and older women. You know, we tend to infantilize them or disrespect them or think that they're useless or whatever. Anyway, is this something that's a part of your perspective, and how do you feel about some of this?
Well, I think obviously important, huge issues. And, you know, we're talking about right now sex, age, but there's all of these other factors that are so, so, so important. And, you know, these pieces that you've talked about in terms of different cultures, it's so important to think about. And you're right. I mean, we have so much to learn. I think different societies and you know, in different ways that older people are, you know, incredibly valued in different places and very much engaged and continue to be engaged, you know, in the societies. And that's something that I think we really want to find ways to strive to make that happen. How do we take advantage of the knowledge, the incredible wealth of knowledge that older people have, and the incredible wisdom that they bring to everything that we're doing, and the roles that they play, especially with the children and the grandchildren? You know, it's incredibly important, the pieces that they do, and something that's hugely valued. And I think that's something that we can do a lot better in our society, and we can certainly learn a lot from what other societies are doing that have done that so well. These people have so much to offer. We absolutely have to find ways to make sure that they're fully contributing in the way that they'd like to do it. And I think some of this is happening in interesting ways. You know, people are starting to think of different ways of living together, or, you know, being connected in ways that maybe we haven't thought about before. So, for example, you know, there's been some projects that we've been hearing about where older people who may have homes and have a lot of space, but maybe are lonely. And we have students coming into towns. You know, we can think about this. This is a university audience, right? And, you know, rent is expensive. And finding a place, I'm hearing, is very hard for students. And they would greatly value being able to live in somebody's home in exchange for, you know, doing some different kinds of things and also developing some incredible relationships as part of that process. So, you know, what a win-win opportunity. These are kind of interesting models that, you know, we need to start thinking about. And also there's examples of older people getting together and saying, hey, I don't want to live on my own. I'm interested in living with people who are like-minded with me and sort of making that happen and coming together and living that way. And then there's the whole scenario of how do you take advantage of, for example, people that aren't living necessarily in just individual homes, but maybe are living in apartment buildings or condos where there's a lot of other people. But let's face it, they're not always connected, you know, and how can we find ways to create connections so that people can have the opportunity to socialize and connect with some of the younger kids and be a resource and contribute in various different ways. These are really interesting models now that we're starting to look at in a way. And there's just so much opportunity there. And lots of things sort of imaginably are coming forward, which I think are great.
Yeah, I think it spans more than just the field of medicine. Like all this research can span, you know, sociology and psychology and anthropology. Like it's huge. You're right. It is quite huge.
One thing that I kind of would love to see with Women's Age Lab, and it's just sort of where this could go, when you're sort of thinking about, you know, being within university environments, there's so many resources there, right? So we're talking, you know, I come from the medical background, so that's my kind of background. You know, other people come from, you know, different aspects of science. But what about architects, for example? What about design? How are we building our cities to create this sort of ability for people to connect? You know, how does this relate to music? I mean, it's just everything that this is relevant to. And so we really have to sort of think outside of our boxes and think about how all of these different people can contribute to making sure that we have health and wellness with aging.
So do you envision this as primarily a research facility, or to also do things like maybe see different subjects of research or people with certain medical conditions that you would study, or this kind of thing, like in a more concrete way?
So we see it as a center. So right now we're all working virtually, and actually, you know, I think that's the way this would evolve, because it's not something that we could ever put everyone in sort of one sort of space. So it's just something that's very much virtually. But I see people coming together from different perspectives and bringing their perspectives to the table, so that we're not just thinking about a person is sick, they need a medication. It has to be much broader than that in terms of our thinking. So involving these various different disciplines and various different perspectives. And I see it involving, you know, not just people that are here with us where we are, you know, in Canada, in the various different provinces, but something that has to involve people from different countries as well, because I think, as you've pointed out, we have a lot to learn from how people practice in different countries. And I know myself, I was able to do some of my training in the UK in the early days and saw, you know, kind of their way of looking for after older people, which involved a lot of going to people's homes and providing support and, you know, doing things in a different kind of way. And also worked in the United States, which had another very different kind of model. But I think we can learn a lot from different countries and different cultures. And so that's something that we certainly want to find ways to engage with as we evolve.
Are you going to be publishing some of your findings, and where can people find out more information about the lab or contact people if they have suggestions or questions or anything like that?
Whenever we put something out, we'll have Women's Age Lab on it. So you'll see our name coming out in that regard. But if you just look for Women's Age Lab at Women's College Hospital, you can come to our website. There's information there. And there's information there, too, about how you can reach out directly. So people are already reaching out from a variety of different areas and sectors and places that I haven't even thought of. And so we just welcome your input and suggestions. So please reach out to us, and we'd love to be in contact with you. Thank you.
And that was The Greenwood, a piece from a recording by the late great Kay Gardner called A Rainbow Path. The Greenwood associated with the color green and with the heart chakra, or the energy point in the body that's around the heart. Before that, you were listening to an interview with the founding director of the Women's Age Lab, Dr. Paula Rochon. For more information about the Women's Age Lab, you can visit their website at the usual www.womensresearch.ca. So that's womensresearch, all one word, .ca/womens, with no apostrophe, just womens-age-lab/. Or you can always just Google Women's Age Lab and you'll find it. It'll direct you right there. I'd like to thank Dr. Rochon for taking the time to be interviewed, and I'd like to thank our spoken word coordinator here at CKUT, Jack Solar, for putting us onto this really great resource. Thank you so much, Jack. Our sister collective member, Rosemary Wally, did an interview with Simri Gomri about the growing opposition to the purchase of fighter jets by our Canadian government. Take it away, Rosemary.
Good evening and Happy New Year to all our listeners. I'm Rosemary Wally, and you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM, feminist radio from an elderly perspective. Peace is our number one issue. Without peace, we can't do anything. So we're going to be talking about peace today, and we have a little music for you in the same vein. This is music by Jan Arden, a beautiful Canadian singer. Cumri Gomri is a local peace and environmental activist who recently founded a chapter of World Beyond War, which is an organization that started in the US maybe around, say, 10 years ago. It works to educate the public by challenging the dominant narrative that might is right. War is never the answer. Here in Canada, our government spends around $23 billion per year on the military, and we're one of the main exporters of military products. So welcome to our show, Cumri.
Hi.
First of all, can we start by talking about this World Beyond War campaign at the moment that we have in Canada, which is against the fighter jets? Tell us, what's a fighter jet?
Well, the fighter jets are a pending purchase by the Canadian government. They want to replace their aging fleet of CF-18 fighter jets with 88 sparkly new fighter jets with nuclear bomb capabilities and all kinds of other fun bells and whistles for a masculinized worldview. So this purchase would ostensibly cost, how much are they quoting? I think it was $18 billion, but in actual fact, it's going to be a lot more than that. It's going to be $77 billion has been calculated for the lifetime cost of these jets. So we just think there are better uses for the money than killing people.
Yeah, I mean, $77 billion is beyond our capacity to imagine, isn't it?
But it really is.
Yes, I know in the States they're spending $100,000 per minute for the next 10 years to improve their nuclear capabilities. So we are sort of like part of that, aren't we? We're a branch plant, really, of the Americans when it comes to weapons.
Yes, you said it exactly.
Now, there are three companies, or there were three, I think there are now only two, that are vying for this purchase, these 88 fighter jets. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about them.
Yes, well, now it's down to two. Initially, there were three contestants, three companies that wanted the contract. One was Boeing with the Super Hornet. They've been eliminated now. So it's down to Lockheed Martin, who's proposing the F-35, and Saab, which is proposing the Gripen. However, all along, some pundits are saying that the whole call for submissions process is to just a bit of a faire semblant, just a bit of something that they're doing as a formality, because they've already decided that they're going to buy Lockheed Martin's F-35s. The reason being because, as you mentioned already, we're kind of patsies to the United States. So this is what we do. And the only reason we're doing this too is because we're part of the NATO, which is also a way of being kind of submissive to the United States war machine.
Now, this is all taxpayers' dollars that they're going to spend on this, right?
Yes, yes, made in US bombers.
Yeah. Now, you have in these planes, as I understand it, just one pilot. They can't help, say this, I don't know. We've had various environmental disasters recently in Canada, floods and et cetera. But a fighter jet couldn't help out communities in a situation like that, could it? They are only for dropping bombs and killing. Is that right?
Yes, that's a very interesting aspect. Yeah, they can't drop water bombs, for example, and put out forest fires, but they can burn 5,600 liters of jet fuel, which is much, much more detrimental to the environment in terms of CO2 emissions than regular gasoline. They burn 5,600 liters of jet fuel an hour, which is just mind-boggling. And it's the equivalent of 1,900 cars on a long one flight. And they also fuel and refuel in midair. So another jet has to fly up alongside the existing jet and refuel in the air so that both of them are burning fuel and emitting greenhouse gases at once. And the amount of just of pollution and greenhouse gases that this would imply is just it's mind-boggling. It's hard to get your head around it. For a while I was writing 19 cars, and then I double checked and it is 1900 cars. One jet equals 1900 cars. It's
wow,
hard to imagine.
Wow. And what about the noise? Presumably they're noisy.
Yes, the noise is they're capable of creating a sonic boom when they take elevation very, very quickly. They can create kind of a booming noise. And there's a documentary about, I think in Vermont, how people have suffered because they're near a military base and the sound of these jets is just, it creates all kinds of health problems in humans. Not only ear hearing loss, but actual physiological problems like headaches and stress and presumably, well, we know too, we're animals and every other animal is affected the same way. So they're just a horrific thing for the environment and for life on Earth.
Yeah, presumably there'd be accidents.
Well, when they crash, and they're quite crash prone, actually, according to a lot of the literature that you see. And because they've got this cool stealth coating, it's a toxic resin that's on them. When they crash, they catch fire, of course, as all planes do when they crash. And then they emit these toxins into the environment. And these toxins are persistent chemicals that's the equivalent of a chemical warfare for all the surrounding. The pilot can eject, so he survives. But everyone that lives in the vicinity of the crash is now irremediably impacted for the rest of time.
Well, yeah, I imagine. Now, why does the Trudeau government insist upon doing this, buying these?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't know what the liberal, what the game is or what. I think that at this point in time, having tried to go through an election and having failed to achieve a majority once again, and having kind of had the word of Canadians that we're not entirely unequivocally happy with the Trudeau government, he's thinking about his legacy because it seems like he will not be reelected as the leader of the Liberal Party. So maybe when he's thinking about his legacy, he'll wonder if he might change his mind and wonder whether he wants his legacy to be, the purchase that, like the pipeline purchase that he made, which he now says he regrets, that will make it impossible for us to meet our commitments for climate, will make it impossible for our species to survive, essentially. He might be thinking about that. I'm hoping he is. If he's not, then I can't explain it.
Yes, because I mean, not too many Canadians prefer $77 billion on fighter jets to say this money going on, I don't know, public transport and housing, and look at the health system.
Yes, this $77 billion could do a lot of amazing things. And one of the things that we have to understand, I just finished filling out the Stephen Guilbeault is now asking for input from the public about the whole climate plan and what our ideas are. And military accounts for, I think, 45% of all emissions in Canada. It's all greenhouse gas emissions. So that's military, and that's not included. It's as though they get a pass, you know, a free pass to just not only to kill people directly, but to kill people indirectly, and for us not to really mention it. So it's a kind of insanity. And I think that, you know, we have to look long and hard at whether we want to continue down the road that we've been on all this time as a species and as a country, and whether we want to really honor, if you can use that word, this military alliance, or whether we want to take a new path for peace, you know?
But I don't think that we have too much choice. We are never really consulted, are we?
Well, we live in a democracy, and even though we might feel that it's a failed democracy and that it's a sham democracy, we still have to fight the good fight, and that's the whole raison d'etre of every activist. Is it's amazing that you know, it's always impossible until it's done. So we just have to keep trying. We have until March when they're going to decide on this purchase. We've printed flyers which give eight reasons, which talks about the eight reasons why. Also, there was a survey of Canadians, and they asked Canadians, the question was, statement was, Canada needs advanced stealth fighter jets to meet its national defense goals. And the majority of people that answered that questionnaire disagreed. So Canadians don't want these. So if we have any democratic voice at all, we have to really protest this and with all our strength. They're toxic. They kill people. They kill the planet. They're anti-Indigenous. And he's all about reconciliation on paper. But why doesn't he put his money where his mouth is? Noise pollution, climate threats. We need the money for other things. They could have degrowth and have a fossil fuel free economy, Green New Deal. We could have shorter work weeks. We could have a sort of a degrowth future in Canada, because I don't know if you know, but greenhouse gases correlate to GDP growth. So as long as we have GDP growth, we're going to have growth of climate change and greenhouse gases that go with it. So we have to look at a kind of a degrowth plan in our climate plan. I hope Mr. Guilbeault's listening. Maybe we can send this to him after.
Great, yeah. But, you know, they always talk about the importance of job creation, like how many jobs would be created by these making of these fighter jets.
Well, if you look at it this way, like the government has $77 billion of our money, of taxpayers' money, presumably, that they're going to use to buy these stealth fighter jets. But they could take that $77 billion that we gave them and use it any way they like and create jobs in any sector, electrifying public transit, implementing basic income, making sure that no child is left behind, pharmacare, you name it. They could have a vision whenever they want. Why are they taking our money and putting it into this military vision of a world gone mad?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think that most people probably have got other things on their mind rather than the spending of our tax dollars on fighting. Yeah. There is a movement, isn't there, Kim, to oppose this publicly.
There really is. There's a great site called No Fighter Jets CA, which pretty much has sample letters that you can send to your MPs. We've been approaching NDP MPs in particular, asking them to speak out against this. You can sign a petition.
Yeah, the NDP is not opposed to the fighter jets, is it?
The NDP is very kind of, no, they haven't been very helpful, but we can write to them just as we would write to any politician or any political party in hopes of, just using our voice for common sense. And there's flyers, there's a flyer campaign, which you know all about because you helped with it.
Congratulations.
Thanks. There are a lot of people just working so hard all across Canada to oppose this. There was also a wonderful campaign earlier last year with, I think it was 100 Canadian celebrities who signed an open letter opposing this purchase. Just amazing people.
If we want more information, where can we go?
I would recommend go to the nofighterjets.ca website, and there everything is there. That's kind of a good starting point.
Okay, and we're going to be out soon, right? Picketing.
Yay!
Offices. I mean, I don't have to say that too loudly today. Cold. But that's what we're going to be doing. And so we invite everybody to join us.
And handing out flyers too, so you can learn all about it and educate other people and kind of spread the word. Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to say about it, Corey?
Well, I just, as the printer said, when I picked up my flyers from the printer, he looked very grave and very, very worried. And he said, well, I hope they can stop this. And I said, thank you. And I said, we have still until March. So we just have to give it our all between now and March and make sure that our government respects the will of the people, which is not to have these fighter jets and to spend our money on better things.
If people would like to join World Beyond War, how can they do that?
They can go to the World Beyond War site and find our chapter and communicate through there, or they can send me send you or me, an email, and I'd be happy to add them to our list of our little burgeoning chapter locally. We could use help with the flyers, especially. So,
I'm in for the flyers.
Yay! The only other thing I forgot to mention, but it's on the flyers, that actually Justin Trudeau promised not to purchase those flyers. Now, I don't know how much we can emphasize these broken promises. But.
The fighter jets, not the flyers. Yeah.
Oh, whoops. Yes.
Justin Trudeau promised not to purchase these fighter jets.
Yeah, he actually, in 2015, he said, we will not buy the F-35 stealth fighter bomber. Those were his exact words.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Rosemary. It was a pleasure.
The song that you chose is Jan Arden singing Peace Train, and it's a beautiful song. Thank you so much. Well, that's our show for January 2022. Unfortunately, our time has once again trickled away, so we invite you all to stay tuned for Amanda on CKUT 90.3 FM.
About the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides the peace terrain. Peace train, take this country, come take me home again. 'Cause I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Peace train sounding loud at night. Friends too, because it's getting nearer, it soon will be with you. Come and join the living, it's not so far from you. Must we go on? past the peace train. Peace train, take this country. Come take me home again.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, back to Amandla here at CQUT 90.3 every Wednesday night on your dial with news, analysis and briefings from the continent of Africa that we don't think you'll find in the mainstream media. And for sure today, we know we have something very special. Gwen, what is on tap?
Yes, well, we're actually returning to, good evening, everybody. We're returning to a podcast by Diraja Press. So as you know, for those of you who listen to Amandla regularly, at the beginning of COVID, Feroz Manji of Diraja Press was producing a number of podcasts, activism in the time of COVID. And so we rebroadcast a number of those. We haven't really done anything from Diraja Press for quite a while. And I came across a beautiful piece that Feroz recently produced. The name of the podcast is Until Everyone is Free, Rekindling Kenya's Overlooked Histories of Resistance. And this caught my eye, Doug, because sometime last year, we participated in a book launch with Diraja Press.
Yeah.
why don't you have a closer connection to that book. So why don't you bring our listeners into what that launch was about, and then I'll bring our listeners into what we're doing tonight.
Well, Feroz Manji is from Kenya by himself.